ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
All right, Nick Bruning, Independent Financial Advisor, joins us. Nick, good evening to you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Phil. Always enjoy joining you in nightlife. It's good fun.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you too. You fully recovered from your...
Look, I swear I was infected by someone from the Barmy Army because I was in amongst it all, Phil, at the first test here in Perth.
Well, you probably were.
Yeah, there I was listening to the chants and thinking of something clever to say back, but I couldn't. But there you go. They're very good. Very funny. Very funny. But yeah. Over it. Thank goodness.
Yeah, all right. Very good. Nick, you have often talked to us about the details of how relatively straightforward it was for Australians who worked in the UK to get access to a UK non-means-tested age pension.
Yeah, look at...
This has suddenly got a bit harder after the UK budget last week.
Yeah, and look, just to remind everyone, this is absolute money for jam for anyone that ever worked in the UK. You don't have to be a UK citizen. You can be an Aussie that's worked there for at least 3 years. And you're right, last Thursday the UK budget came down and there was a bit of a bombshell, to be honest, for anyone overseas that is making use of that pension scheme. Well, I should say people that aren't yet in the scheme but are waiting for their age to hit 66, which is the current UK age pension age. Anyway, what's happened is, and just to remind everyone, the way the system works is, as you mentioned, it's non-means tested. In order to qualify for 1035ths, which is the minimum amount that you can receive, you have to have 10 years worth of membership in the scheme. Now, if you are lucky enough to have worked there for 3 years, you can actually make back payments to the scheme to get you up over that 10-year minimum. And the maths are just brilliant. It works out that with the money that you send back, you literally are getting back about a 52% return on your investment for life once you get to age pension age. And it's better because it's actually a percentage of the UK pension at the time you retire that you'll be entitled to. So the changes are this. Firstly, they're getting rid of the lower Class 2 contributions. Now, that means that instead of only having to pay £180 per year, you're now going to have to pay £923 per year. So that's a massive five-fold increase in the rate that you'd have to pay. The other real nasty little thing is I mentioned that three-year minimum to be able to be a part of the scheme. You can contribute 7 years to get up to the 10. From April next year, you must have at least 10 years to be able to even put anything into it. So the message here is for anyone that's worked in the UK for at least 3 years, not quite 10, or maybe you're at the 10, whatever, you need to head along to the Department of Work and Pensions website in the UK. You've got until April 5th next year to sort this all out, because after that date, the rules change. And I can tell you last time, Phil, I don't remember, when we spoke about this a couple of years ago, I think Nightlife was single-handedly responsible for blowing up the UK pension website.
I know.
So many inquiries.
We were. I'm not worried about this, Nick, but I just also wonder whether or not someone in the UK Treasury said, hello, what's going on here? We've just had no... I was just listening to Australian radio the other night, and these blokes down under... These colonists down under are plundering our pension fund. Let's do something about it.
Yeah, well, I have to say, I think that we're good big fans of it. There's no question about it. But there's a lot of expat Brits that live here now, and of course, those that went over there to work during their perhaps just after they graduated from school or uni, racked up that 3 years and have come back. And to be fair too, they were having money taken out of their pay to pay towards the stamps, as they used to call them, back in the UK. So you know, it's not as though they haven't already paid money into the scheme. It's just about topping it up to get the minimum pension.
So what can you do about it?
Well, as I said, head along to the Department of Work and Pensions website, and you can actually type in overseas pensions or abroad. Pensions abroad is what they like to refer to us as, and it should tell you the new changes. But it's out there. There's a couple of organisations that'll be talking about it, and we'll certainly try to get the message out. But I guess the good listeners on Nightlife have got the scoop on this. This is the change that's happening. And look, it's subject to passage through Parliament, much like what happens here. But given the parlous state of the UK finances, government finances at the moment, I don't think there'll be too much opposition to making these changes.
No, Nick Bruning's here with us. 1300 800 222. That's the number. Line's free if you want to grab one. Text 0467922702. Is it better to top up a mortgage or take out a personal loan, says my texter?
Top up a mortgage or take out a personal loan. They might mean take money out of the mortgage. You're probably better off taking it out.
I think that's what they mean.
So you are absolutely better off taking out of the mortgage on the basis that the interest rate you're going to be charged is less.
Is lower.
Almost in both cases, they're non-tax deductible debt. We like to see people reduce that debt as quickly as possible based on the higher the interest rate, the quicker you want to get rid of it. So if you can get something, and you're only paying 6%, say, as an interest rate versus a personal loan, which I think these days is around about 11 or 12%, you're paying half the interest, and it absolutely makes sense.
Hmm. Okay, Phil, a question.
Yeah, there's a trick to that. Make sure the payments, how about this? Make sure the payments are at the same rate as if it was 12%, because that way you'll get rid of it quicker.
Oh, yeah. Peter says, if I have a joint account with my partner, if he or she passes away, can the other access the money before a grant of probate?
So there's two ways of ownership. Joint ownership generally implies that you are both joint owners, and through a process called survivorship, which I think applies in pretty much every state, the other party or the other partner to the joint account automatically assumes the entire asset. So that would include bank accounts. It also includes properties and things like that. Right. So it should be okay. However, that said, sometimes the banks will want to know about it. But look, I know quite a lot of people that are still operating joint accounts after the passing of their partner, and there's no issue there.
Mm. Glenda says, once the account is changed from accumulation to pension phase, this is your super account.
Yep.
Can a financial advisor add enough value to warrant their not insubstantial fees? Now, in this Glenda's case, she says they've provided some reasonable strategies so far, but I think their fees outweigh the benefit once I'm into pension phase.
Yeah, well, it's the old debate, Phil. Are you getting value for money? Yeah. So in my view, if that's all they're doing is basically supervising the account-based pension, then I'd be questioning what sort of fees you are paying for that. So a good financial planner in retirement will be doing these things. First of all, they will absolutely be looking at the portfolio mix. And as we've mentioned many times on the show, when you've got a fund that's in profit, all the shares have gone through the roof and everything's looking great, you should be tweaking your portfolio at least every 6 months or so to take the profits when they're there to replenish the cash pool, so that that's where your regular payments come from. And when things have gone to the proverbial and the markets are down, you can sit tight knowing that you've got enough money in the cash pool to meet your regular payments. Now, the other part of retirement, which is as important, frankly, is that the good financial planners will also be liaising with your behalf with Centrelink. So they'll be the people that will be updating Centrelink on your behalf, telling them that you've taken certain money out to buy a car and the caravan's depreciated since last year. One way to check is to see if your financial planner has access to a system called Proda, which is the digital portal, if you like, for financial professionals to interact with Services Australia, including Centrelink. So if you ask your financial planner, have you got access to Proda, and they give you a blank stare, there's a good chance they don't. And I just think that's really the service that I would be expecting someone to receive if they're paying hefty amounts in fees. Unfortunately, it's a sad thing that we see situations where advisors do, frankly, very little, and they're charging people 1% in fees for advisor fees, on $1 million portfolio, Phil, that's 10 grand a year. That's a lot of money. And as I've sometimes joked, for 10 grand a year, I'd expect someone out the front every Saturday mowing my lawns and washing the car for those sorts of amounts. But if you get a sense, you feel at the moment that you're not getting value for money, then, it's probably a good time to start asking questions.
Mm. Julian Springwood says, if you've got $2 million in super, is it true that you can't make any further non-concessional contributions?
Yes, that's right. There's a thing called the transfer balance cap, which is the amount of money that you can actually transfer from accumulation phase to the pension phase. And the part about the pension phase, it's completely tax-free, Phil. So none of the earnings are taxed, and any money you take out of the super fund if you're over 60, that's completely tax-free as well. So when you get to that later stage in life, as you're approaching that $2 million figure, the government doesn't want you overloading the system and well, in their view, rorting it. So you can it restricts the amount of non-concessional contribution. So that's the money that you can pay in voluntarily where you don't claim a tax deduction. Mm. Currently, that limit is $120,000 per year. Interestingly, it doesn't limit non-concessional contributions, Phil. So if you're eligible to make non-concessional contributions to super, if you satisfy the work test or if you're under 67, then you can still make that. In that case, it's a limit of $30,000 per year. You wouldn't have any carryover by definition of the fact you've got $2 million, and that would be subject to a contributions tax of 15%.
Mm. Nick Bruning is with us. 1-300-800-222. There are lines free if you would like to grab a question. Nick, my texter says, my 18-year-old son's investing $200 a week into an ETF, NDQ. Mm-hmm. I don't know what that is.
Mm, no.
I think he should split it to $100 US and $100 Australia. Any ETF suggestions, please, for an Australian ETF?
Yeah, look. What's an ETF, just for everyone's NDQ? Benefit, I think it's the NASDAQ NDQ. ETF. I'm not sure. But look, just so that everyone understands what our text is talking about, an ETF is an exchange-traded fund. It's a bit like a managed fund, but it invests in actual listed shares most of the time. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about if it is a NASDAQ ETF, then it's going to be investing in things like Google and Alphabet, Apple, NVIDIA, all those sorts of big tech stocks. Look, I guess, yes, that's all likely to be in US dollars. You can actually usually get what we call hedged versions of those, which is like an Australian dollarized version of the fund. But I like the idea of investing in Australian shares as well. I think the general consensus, Phil, is that a lot of this, particularly this tech stuff over in the US, is somewhat overvalued. There's lots of questions going about the investment into AI and how much money people have borrowed to stick money into AI. And even today, I was watching one of the business channels from overseas, and they were saying, "Whoa, jeepers, you know, a lot of banks have got a lot of money exposed to this AI. If it doesn't work and generate the sort of revenue they hope, then there could be some banks in some trouble." So anyway, I think we're away from another financial crisis, but there's some serious concerns and wobbles. So, it's all about diversification. And while an ETF does give you some diversification, it can be quite specific in the case of a NASDAQ or even, you know, an Australian resources ETF.
So you think this idea of splitting it. Yeah.
Yep.
And my texter says, any suggestions for an Australian ETF? Well, there are
Personally, there's different sorts of ETFs. In the past, they tended to be mainly index huggers, as we call it, where they would replicate the index. Mm. There are some variants coming out now. One of the things that worries me is that, and this is getting right into the weeds of this stuff, Phil, some of them use a fair amount of synthetics, which means they don't actually own the underlying assets. So, in other words, you're kind of betting that the company issuing the ETF is going to be around forever, and it just gets a bit messy. So I tend to like the bog-standard boring ETFs, the ones that perhaps replicate the S&P 200 or the All Ordinaries Index or something like that. There's fancier ones out there, but I'm a conservative guy, Phil. You know, I have to face people when things go backwards.
Nothing wrong with that with money. All right, 1-300-800-222. Quentin from Adelaide. G'day, Quentin.
Hello. I have a question. I'm just winding down work, and my partner, 75, hasn't worked for applying to link for a pension, and it seems to be quite difficult to do. It's taken about a year, and we've been knocked back and raised objections and stuff like that. We've been advised, she has a share portfolio of a bit under 500 held in a family trust, of which she is the sole beneficiary. And we had a advice that Centrelink would deem that she is earning less from that if the shares were transferred to her in her own name rather than being held in a family trust. Does that sound right?
Oh, yeah. So what Centrelink tend to do with vehicles like family trusts and companies and all those sorts of things, they actually look at the distributions of the trusts for the previous 12 months or the entity and apply it for the following 12 months. And that's because you know, most accountants do a bit of a fiddle of diddle at the end of the year, and it's sort of not quite sure what you've got until you've got it. So for that very reason, Centrelink apply it for the following 12 months as the previous 12 months. So that trust may have been involved in all sorts of other little things. It might have been selling some shares, buying some shares, I don't know. But if the shares were held in your wife's name, then you will find that it will be simply caught under the deeming system. And that says that the first, and you're a couple, so the first 106,200 will be deemed to be earned just 0.75% and everything above that at 2.75%. So it could be more favourably treated under the income test that way. But usually, Quinton, it's the asset test that knocks most people off. And what you would need to be assured of is that you as a couple, over and above the family home, no matter what its value is under 1.074 million. So if all of your assets other than the family home are under 1.074 million, then you would qualify under the asset test. Hope that makes a bit of sense, but that's the logic behind moving it to a into your wife's name.
Okay. Thank you. And there'd be an officer at Centrelink who could give us this sort of advice?
Yeah. Well, they're very, very quick to say they don't give advice, they give information. But Centrelink have a terrific service called the Financial Information Service Office, FISOs for short. And if you were to ring 132300, and it sounds like you might be in the car, so 132300 for everyone else, and then select the appointment with a FIS officer, you can usually take your shoebox in with all the stuff and lay it out to them, and they'll probably tell you hopefully what I've just explained to you.
Okay.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Quinton. Okay. Thanks, Quinton. 1-300-800-222 is the number if you would like to call. There are lines free, so grab one. My question, I'm 25, says my texter. I'm 25 years old. I'd like my super to be ethically invested, but I'm worried about the risk of getting further down the line of my working life and finding I've shot myself in the foot in regard to return on investment compared to other super options. Can you explain and offer your opinion?
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting question. So this ESG issue, it's environment, social conscience, if you like, and governance. So they need to be running the show properly. There are actually rating houses out there that score them. And there was actually a dedicated socially responsible super fund for a while, and I think they certainly have them as options for a lot of schemes. The data, when I last looked at it, which is admittedly a couple of years ago, Phil in our texter, showed that they're pretty much on par. That was, I think, over about a 4 or 5 year period. They're not that new, but they haven't been around long, if that makes sense. Mm. So you've kind of got a 5 year track record where you can compare it. And I think from memory, they certainly are comparable. They didn't stand out as being demonstrably worse off, and they didn't stand out as being demonstrably better off. So you're probably okay. And then, I mean, the key thing in all of this is to have the appropriate asset allocation. And if you're a young person, then you've got, you know, decades to go before you can even access your super. So I'm very keen for younger people to have their money in the more aggressive investment options. Sure, it's as volatile as hell. It goes up and down and all over the place. But statistically, it shows that over a long period of time, we're talking, you know, 30, 40 years, you'll definitely come out better off than if you'd been in a conservative type fund. The conservative funds are brilliant for someone that, you know, loses sleep at night when they hear about the market doing this or that. And similarly for people as they get into the latter years of life in retirement, you know, I would have pretty much everyone I look after in the conservative type mix in retirement. Just so that they can sleep at night.
Yeah, well, exactly right. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Can Nick please repeat the name of the service some financial planners have with Centrelink, says Leslie.
Sure, it's called PRODA. Now, I know that I can rattle off the acronym, Phil. I think it stands for Provider something other, Digital Access. They were professional digital access. How's that? PRODA. That sounds like. That sounds right. Anyway, PRODA is the service.
PRODA.
Yep. And, you know, all good financial planners that are working in the retirement space, well, in my opinion, good financial planners working in the retirement space have access to PRODA. And look, the thing is, people think, oh, you know, I'll never qualify for a pension. Well, you might not qualify for a pension, but, you know, I know a lot of people that don't know they qualify for a thing called the Commonwealth Seniors Health Card, which is a concession card that, you know, people with millions of dollars would qualify for if they knew how it worked. And similarly, you know, some adjustments to their portfolio, not in terms of selling this and buying that, but actually what holds it, like in super and stuff. You know, none of the money you pull out from super, for example, in retirement counts towards that Commonwealth Seniors Health Card number. So, you know, it's a misunderstood benefit, but again, some financial planners who have nothing to do with Centrelink kind of turn their noses up at it, won't be in a position to tell their clients because they don't know about it.
Yep, you should certainly, mate, take advantage of that if you can. You really should. Mm. Grant says, any experience with bringing retirement funds from Canada back to Australia? Should I do it as a lump sum into my Australian super or wait till I'm retired and then trickle it home in bits and pieces? Or another option?
I really haven't had a lot to do with Canada, but I have had a lot to do with this sort of strategy with people from the UK and things. One of the things I always look at is to see, well, what exactly are you giving up? And when we've explored this with some of the UK pension schemes, so yeah, you've got the option of cashing it out. You're actually better off keeping it there. And when you get to retirement, as Texter has said, Grant, whoever it was, you know, dripping it through. The issue is that you can't easily roll it into your Australian superannuation scheme. Again, I'm not overly familiar with the Canadian laws, but generally speaking, you'd probably have to make a contribution here. So you need to weigh up the Canadian tax of getting it out there. It comes over here, then you contribute it into super as often a non-concessional contribution. There are other complicated things that the POMs had called QROPs and stuff, which allowed you to transfer within, if you like, the superannuation systems. But again, quite messy, and I'm not sure that by the time you pay all the fees and stuff, it necessarily stacks up. So explore option two first. See what you're going to be giving up if you do commute the pension and take it as a lump sum now, or if you're not that far from retirement, you might be better off just getting that Canadian pension.
Okay, thanks. That texter who's saying is 132300 the number for Fizzo. Yes, it is. Yep. Yes, it is. Greg on the Gold Coast. G'day, Greg.
Good evening, gents.
Hi, Greg.
Just a question. I was working in the US and I was 6 months short of 10 years. And I guess retirement was the last thing I was thinking about just before I left. And just what you touched on earlier with the UK, I was just wondering if there was any sort of direction you could suggest someone in my position that's just short of the 10 years of a similar position in the US.
Look. That's a great question, Greg, and I've never had that question asked, and it's probably worth sending some sort of correspondence to the IRS. Have you looked on the IRS website at all, or the Social Security website in the States?
Yes, I have a statement from them each year that tells me that I'm sure.
Right. Look, it might be as simple. I say simple. It might be as simple as writing back to them via email and saying, look, I'm 1 year short. Can I make a contribution from here in Australia? To get me over the threshold, because that's essentially what we were talking about with the UK people. Right. And I honestly don't know, but it might be as simple as that. I might actually follow that up next year, Greg. That's an interesting question because there's a few people working in the US these days.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Greg. Okay. Bye-bye. Where are we? Terry from Hobart. G'day, Terry.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question?
I'm on a disability pension. I'm 67. I'm old enough for age pension, but I stayed on the disability pension. But I own a rural property where I live, and they asked me what it was valued at, and I said, well, the last valuation I got was $145,000. That was about 10 years ago, and I'm just wondering, I've got no idea if it's gone up or down or where it's gone in the meantime, but.
Okay. So, Terry, a couple of things there. Centrelink, how long have you lived on that property, by the way?
Oh, it'll be close on 18, 20 years, I reckon.
Okay. Well, 20 years is actually a magic figure in the scheme of things here. So if there's a special exemption which extends the homeowner asset test exemption for someone that's been on the same property on a single title for 20 years or more, okay? So if you get over that 20-year figure or date, then the value of the property is is fully exempt, no matter how big it is. But with the conditions are that, one, you've lived in it continually for 20 years, tick that box. Two, that you're making full use of it, having regard to your abilities and the state of the land. So, for example, if you've got a sheep station and you're 96, you're not expected to be running around chasing after sheep, right? You can have it as vacant land. But if you're someone that's 67 and sort of could possibly do something with the land and it was being used up in that purpose just before you retired, then Centrelink might ask some questions about that. And if even if not, how many hectares, acres are we talking about?
Oh, it's about 52 point something hectares.
Hectares, okay. So you're exempt on the first 2 hectares with all the buildings and all the stuff that sort of form part of the property, as long as they're not being used for commercial purposes.
Well, I do primary production on it. Like, I've got a few sheep right there, and I have to do a profit and loss every year for
It'll be the asset value. Yeah, Terry, it'll be the asset value. So so what Centrelink are likely to do, if you put in a value of 145 grand and they look at it and they go, "You've got to be kidding me." And then they go, they will get it valued, and you'll have you'll be told what that value is. You do have the right to sort of question it if you think that's not right. You know, if it turns out that 30 hectares of rock and you can't do anything with it, then you can talk about that. But that's generally the process that's about to commence. So have you got a rough idea? I know you said 145, but would it be worth over, say, $1 million? Sounds like it would.
I don't doubt it. It's like, it's vacant land. It's up in the Midlands. Like, yeah, it's not around. I mean, okay. It's just classed as vacant land. I just got a shed and a van there, and I live there.
You live on it? Yeah. You live on it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, look, let's see how it plays out. But that's how they're going to treat it. So if you're 20 years, you're probably in a better position. But if less than 20 years, they'll look at it and it may count that area over the 2 hectares.
Okay, Terry. Mm. Thanks, mate. Thank you for the call. Deborah in Old Bar. G'day, Deb.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, Deborah.
Remember when NRMA turned, they gave you all these stocks?
Oh, yeah, demutualised.
Yeah, they demutualised, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I had 100 shares like 30 years ago. And I rolled it over. And I have moved quite a few times, and I haven't told the tax department about them. And like, I've been hiding from them.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Now I'm on pension.
Yeah.
What's going to happen when I look, I admit to that I own a share?
Well, let's think about that. Are you on a full pension?
I'm on a carer pension.
Okay, so you're looking after someone, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, and can I ask, is that the full pension that you're receiving, the full carer pension?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. And do you know roughly what the value of the shares are?
No, I don't. I don't have any idea. I'm too scared to look.
Yeah, okay. Well, look, hopefully it's not massive amounts. I would tell them. I wouldn't be too scared about it. Generally speaking, if you're on a full pension, it means that your assets as a couple are under $481,500, excluding the value of the family home. So, if you total up what you got in the bank and you think, well, jeepers, we've only got, $200,000, whatever the figure is, plus the house, then you're $281,000 under the threshold. It's very unlikely those NRMA shares are going to be worth $281,000, okay?
Okay.
So it sounds like it's not the end of the world for you, my dear. I would I'd probably either make a phone appointment or wander into Centrelink and say, look, I've just realised I've got these and I should have told you. I suspect it's not going to make any difference. Can I ask roughly how much you do have in other stuff, shares, bank accounts, all that? What would it be with you and your partner combined?
We have about 30,000. So.
My dear, you have nothing to worry about. Get in there, go and tell them about it. You're all good.
All good, Deb.
Yep.
Don't worry about a thing. All righty, 1-300-800-222.
I like helping people like that, Phil.
Morris is over 67, still working. Good on you, Morris. Hi, Morris.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good.
How can I help?
Okay, so full-time work, 67. What are the restrictions on super?
Okay, so you've hit 67 years, 65 years of age a couple of years ago, so you've got no restriction access to getting money out of super whatsoever. You can pull it out whenever you want, some of it or all of it, and you will pay no tax because you're over 60 years of age. As far as continuing to contribute to super, because you satisfy the work test, and that is that you're doing more than, I assume you're doing, more than 40 hours of work in the 30-day consecutive period, and you only have to do it once in the financial year, you can continue to contribute to super up to $30,000 per year. That would include what the boss is paying in under the compulsory super rules. And if you've got less than $500,000 in super, you can probably even put in a little bit more if you haven't made full use of super over the last few years. So the world is your oyster, Morris, because you can, you know, almost use super like a whiz bang bank account. You can pay money into it, get a tax deduction for it, and you can rip it straight out again and not pay any tax. It's something that people in that situation where we often recommend salary sacrificing, because you'll end up only paying 15% tax.
I put 100% in salary sacrifice.
Okay, one little pointer. Because yes. You're over, are you a single or a member of a couple?
Single.
Okay, here's the thing. Because you're a single over 67, you have access to a thing called the Seniors and Pensioners Tax Offset, which is a hell of a mouthful of stuff. But what it basically means is that you can earn up to $35,813 per year, Morris, and not pay a cent in tax, okay? So if you salary sacrifice your income below $35,813, understand that the super fund still has to whip out the 15% contributions tax. They're not looking at what you're earning to see if you would pay any tax at all. So what I'd be suggesting is that you don't salary sacrifice below $35,813 because you're kind of wasting money on 15% contributions tax. Does that make sense?
I understood that the tax-free threshold was just over $18,000.
No. You get access to these two offsets. There's a low-income tax offset and a senior and pensioners tax offset. That combined with Medicare concessions means that you can earn $35,813 as a single person over 67 and not pay tax.
Is that gross?
Yep.
Okay, so anything over that, you're paying
tax? You're paying tax? No, you'd be paying your normal tax rates. Well, So what the trick is to salary sacrifice down to that point and then don't go any further.
Okay.
Great. Thanks,
Morris.
For that.
Thanks, Morris.
There you go.
Good luck with it. And thanks to everyone who's texted in saying that NRMA shares or IAG shares are about $8 last time we looked. So
it's got 800.
Deb, don't worry about a thing. Deb,
well,
do
thank
not
you for
worry
our
about
article.
A thing. Yeah. I mean, it may be disappointing for you if you thought you were sitting on a massive pile.
That's right. Yeah.
They're about $8 each, Deb, so don't worry about it.
I suspect Deb will sleep better tonight, and that's much better than the $8.
Thanks. thank you, Jill. Says actually, I just checked it. It's $7.70, says Jill.
Ooh.
So 100 shares would be worth $770.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. I haven't put my tax returns in for 3 years. Don't think I owe anything. Will I be fined?
No. What happens is you go and do it, and if you go to the my.gov.au portal.
They don't usually fine you, do they?
If they were particularly, pedantic and you got an assessment, you just ring them up and you say, look, I'm sorry, I have terrible couple of years. Well, whatever the reasons were, and they're pretty forgiving, Phil, and then they will what they call remit the fines and penalties, and it'll end up with zero. What I find with most people that haven't lodged their tax return, they think they're going to cop a fine or some sort of this or that. They end up getting a tax refund because they forget that the boss has been taking money out, and that money's been sitting there in Jim Chambers' Jim Chalmers' bank, well, not his personal bank account, but in Canberra. And if they, they only get it back when they claim it. So
that's
it comes.
I know. I said that to a friend of mine, but well, not friend, acquaintance actually, but he hadn't put a tax return in for a long time.
Yeah,
and he was terrified. You know, I got to the stage where he was just terrified. You know, that he was going to go to jail or something.
Yeah.
I said, look, just front, you know, fess up, front up. I said, you'll find actually that you'll probably get a lot of money back. You know,
which he did. Glenn, my record is $23,000.
Glenn.
For one bloke. He actually bought me a nice bottle of something. But, yeah, $23,000 I thought it was pretty good.
Glenn from Pakenham. G'day, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, gents.
Hi.
Glenn.
What's your question, Glenn?
I have $700,000 in super.
Mm-hmm.
I'm currently working for the Dole, and I turned 66 today.
Right.
So I've got a year to I get the pension. Mm-hmm. I just don't know whether I will get the pension or part pension or how it will work.
Glenn, are you a single gent or are you
yes,
a couple?
Single.
Okay. And do you own your own home?
Yes.
Okay. So when you get there, this number will have changed in a year's time thereabouts. The threshold at the moment for you to have a reduced pension because of the asset test, and that's the one that will affect you, is $321,500, and it gets canned altogether when you get to $714,500, okay? So by the time you get there, I expect it'll be somewhere closer to $740,000, $750,000, something like that. All right, so you're going to get some pension, but you're not going to get a lot because you've got so much tied up in super. So all of the things that you might want to do to get yourself in a better position, and, you know, let's be honest, enjoy yourself a bit. It might be improving the house so that it becomes more retirement ready for you. If you move money from super into your house effectively by doing renovations or repairs, that kind of stuff, you're effectively moving money from where an area where Centrelink would look at it to where they don't look at it. You can also do things like prepay your funeral. As a macabre thing that might sound, money that you pay towards a funeral fund, and I'm not talking about that dreadful funeral insurance stuff that you see on afternoon TV, but where you prepay the funeral, that is also exempt from Centrelink assessment. And even helping out the kids or the grandies or something like that, you've got gifting rules up to 10 grand that you can do. And you can also spend it because I can tell you, Glenn, that every $10,000 you expend between now and when you hit pension age will get you an extra $30 per fortnight of pension then. So as bizarre as it sounds, it's like a 7.8% return on your money, spending money, because you $10,000 turns out to be $30 a fortnight, and $30 a fortnight over a year is $780. So there you go.
Okay. All right, Glenn. Thanks, mate. No worries. Good luck. 1-300-800-222. Greg in Geelong says, I didn't put a tax return in for 17 years. Mm-hmm. My accountant nephew helped me out, and I got $45,000 back in a tax return. There you go.
Well, I hope you looked after your nephew. Bloody golly.
help Tyler out. He's in Brisbane. Tyler says, I've been dealing with the aged care system for my dad for the past 3 months, and I've had better insights from catching segments like this on the ABC than I have from trying to engage with the system itself. I'm very thankful. My dad is 71 and in respite care. He's coming back home soon with the aim to stay home. Yep. I'm in the midst of trying to figure out his finances, which mostly entails waiting for the post to deliver the mail and finding another bank statement or super statement and so on. Mm-hmm. Across various bank accounts, term deposits, a small bit of super, he seems to have about $250,000. In all these random places, earning minimal interest.
Yeah.
I've no idea where I would start in researching a better option for this cash with minimum financial knowledge.
Yeah, okay. So there are some financial planners.
Tyler's in Brisbane,
Brisbane, okay. So there's a couple of independent financial planners up there that have got some expertise in aged care. So if you head along to the CIFA.asn.au website, so that's CIFAA.asn.au website, the Certified Independent Financial Advisors Association. There are some Brisbane aged care people up there that will be able to help you. One of the things that I'll probably talk about, it would be a good idea to have a frank chat with Dad about getting a thing called an enduring power of attorney in place.
Yeah.
That will allow you to go and sort of make those investigations, contact the various funds, and you can become kind of the steward of all that stuff. And not only that, you can also, again, via the my.gov.au website, become Dad's nominee so that you can interact with Centrelink and My Aged Care and all of those terrific services on Dad's behalf. It's going to make it a lot easier when you get all the stuff together rather than trying to gather up bits and pieces. Once you've done that, you can. There's some terrific calculators on the my.gov.au website where you can plug in the numbers and have a look at how Dad comes out. The reason I'm a bit hesitant, it sounds like he might be close to low means. We don't know if he's a homeowner. He says he's moving home, but we don't know if that's a place that he owns. We don't know if there's a partner involved. All these things complicate how you're assessed when it comes time to move into residential aged care. But understand that in Australia, you pay a thing called a refundable accommodation deposit, but people with low means, as they're classified, are entitled to much better support, much greater support from the federal government. So, yeah, worth exploring. CIFAA.asn.au, but after perhaps you've got an EPA set up for them.
Okay. Thanks, Tyler. Thanks, Nick. Thomas in Horsham. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you going?
Pretty good. Thanks. Hi, Thomas. What's your question, Thomas?
Talking about going into a self-managed super fund to buy a rural property, a farming property, to retire on in about 20 years' time. Good idea, bad idea, good.
Thomas, you need to get some. I'd be very careful about that. There's some very strict rules with self-managed super funds regarding assets for personal use. Now, it's a moot point, I guess, about having a farming property on it, because certainly farming properties are in self-managed super funds. But I would be getting some advice on it. There's some issues with the whole thing regarding putting all your eggs into one basket and hoping that the property does well. I understand it's, you know, the super looks like a big cash pool that we can use and do all these great things with, but every principal sort of puts up alarm bells about diversification of assets. How do you meet the minimum payments from the fund as you get older? You know, it's all good when you're only having to pay yourself 5% per year, but by the time you get to 85, you're having to pay yourself 9% per year. Would the farm be generating that sort of cash flow and stuff? We'll probably get inundated with people that are doing exactly what I'm saying, perhaps get some advice on, but, you know, I like super for its sole purpose, which for me is generating a capital source for retirement income that you can use as you require, and you've got maximum flexibility with it. So anyway, hope I haven't talked you out of it. Make some inquiries. Make sure you fully understand what's going on before you sign up for one. But interestingly enough, Phil, that I think we might have spoken about it last time, ASIC's just done a report into self-managed super funds, highly critical. It found that more than 60% of the files they examined, 100%, were conflicted by the advice that was provided and probably not suited. So
I think amber light warning.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Yep.
Thanks, Thomas. All right. This is Nick Bruning. Nick is an independent financial advisor, and he can offer you independent financial advice. He's from the CIFAA, which is the Certified Independent Financial Advice Association, and their website is CIFAA.asn. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Michael from Perth. G'day, Michael.
Oh, hello, Philip. Hello, Nick.
Hi.
Hi, Michael.
The reason I'm calling, I've been self-employed for most of my life. I've really got bugger all super, so what I want to try and do, I'm 60 years old now. I've paid off my home. I have about $70,000 in redraw available to me. Is it worth me taking that money out and putting it into my super using the $30,000 a year cap as much as I can?
Probably not, Michael, because if you're going to borrow the money, then you're going to be paying 6%, 7%, or whatever, 6% interest for it. And you're kind of relying on the super fund doing better than the 6%, right? And it would be nice, and it's done quite well, but it's always a risk. There's no risk that you're going to be charged 6%, right? There is a risk that you won't make 6% in the super fund. So I'm a bit wary of that. What I would be doing, if you're in the great position that you've paid off your mortgage and well done, I'd absolutely be smashing the stuff called salary sacrifice. So the payments that you're paying on the mortgage, you can now pay into super, claim it as a tax deduction if you've got bugger all super, as you mentioned. You can also make use of unused previous contributions to super. So if you have a good year, in theory, you could put it, and you haven't put any into super and claim it as a tax deduction for the last 5 years. In theory, this year you could put in up to $167,500 and claim it as a deduction. Yeah. So, you know, there's all sorts of little tricks. Your accountant, I'm sure you've got an accountant if you're self-employed, will be across of all those little tricks. So when you catch up with him or her at the end of the year or midway, have a chat about doing that, but there's nothing to stop you smashing the super with those freed up mortgage repayments, and well done you.
Mm, okay. Thank you, Michael. I've probably got time for one last one, have we? John from Woodvale in WA. G'day, John.
Oh, hello.
Hi, John.
Hi, John. What's your question?
Hello, Nick. Well, we went to an advisor a couple of years ago, and I was nearing the end of my working life, and he said, we sort of gave him a brief to simplify financial affairs. He said, close down your SMSF and go into a retail fund. So I'm practically retired now, and I have to pay $240 a month admin fee for the SMSF. That's the only fees I pay on it because we haven't got a financial advisor attached to it.
Yeah.
What do you think of that advice?
Well, what, to get out of the self-managed super fund and put it into a low-cost public scheme?
That's sort of recommended.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree. Well, and I don't know your circumstances. I need to qualify with that. But look, I shake my head at people that get told to set up a self-managed super fund without fully being explained what's involved in running it. And when I look at the returns on a lot of self-managed super funds, John and Phil, and you compare it to what they would have received in the hand had they left it with one of the big, good, well-run funds, you know, they're often much, much worse off. So I'm all for making things simple, particularly as you're approaching retirement. I would say that, simplification is one of the objectives. You want to be sitting on a beach somewhere getting a sunburnt backside, John, when you're retired. You don't want to be sitting on the laptop checking to see what the share prices have done from one day to the next. And, that's kind of what self-managed fund almost requires. There'll be a lot of people that say, oh, you set and forget. But, it comes with a lot of responsibility, and I'm not a big fan of them, as you can tell.
No. All right, John. Thank you. Just before you go, Nick, the exodus from the financial planning industry is gathering pace. There are even fewer planners to go around these days. There are new and strict requirements, aren't there, including a higher education qualification.
A lot of people might say
that's good.
Absolutely fantastic. Yeah. It is. But the problem is, Phil, that there's also another group which ASIC have let sort of stay on, and they are the people that have got 10 years of experience. Now, what we're finding is, and just giving you the numbers, at the moment there were 28,000 before the Royal Commission financial advisors. The number is now 15,459. Wow. And ASIC have indicated right now, so we're talking 3 weeks away, 2,326 still haven't indicated their compliance. So we're talking 15% of the industry potentially get shut down on the 1st of January next year. It's a big problem. The number of financial advisors, good ones out there, is unfortunately shrinking, and it just means potentially costs will go up. So watch this space, I guess. But there's a lot of very good people getting kicked out. Some people that are ex-Centrelink and stuff that didn't quite get the 10 years, but I would frankly put them well ahead above some of those that have been around for 10 years, because what I've discovered is that competence does not automatically come with experience. You've got to have that technical training.
Julie in the Blue Mountains says, evening, Phil. Unfortunately, not submitting tax returns is a well-known ruse for avoiding the payment of child support. Hopefully these loopholes will be closed at some point.
Yeah,
that's right. I don't think that was our callers tonight. But thank you, Julie, for making the point. Appreciate it. All right, Nick, look, we're going to catch up with you again in a couple of weeks, because I know your book, Don't Panic, is out. We're going to talk about that. And we'll have a special session on retirement planning itself.
Looking forward to it, Phil. Thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to that too. So I know you've updated your things about that. So we're going to concentrate on retirement planning with Nick. Apart from general financial advice, we're going to talk about retirement planning with Nick in a couple of weeks. So, Nick, look forward to that. And in the meantime, keep well.
And thanks, Phil. And great fun as always. Cheers.
Good on you. Nick Bruning will be with us, as I say, again in a couple of weeks. And we'll concentrate on what. So, the basis of his book, Don't Panic, which is about retirement planning and advice.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.